Jayaratna, 2nd of May 1967.
Well, you see, 1956 marked the emergence of a group educated in Sinhala, primarily. That would be the Sinhalese schoolmaster, the Ayurvedic physician, the Buddhist priest, the peasant, and the trade union. That was considered the Pancha Mahabalavegya of Bandaranaike. And it is that group that polarized around Bandaranaike through the three or four other political parties which supported the SLSP. Then, it also gave a place under the sun for those who talked the Sinhala language, as I said, and whose religion was Buddhist. So that was, in the villages generally, the oppressed, economically oppressed sections of the population. So I believe that when we did campaign in 1956, almost invariably our instructions were to emphasize these two points, Sinhala Buddhism on the one hand, and the economically oppressed on the other.
Mm-hmm. Now you were campaigning then as a member of the Communist Party.
As a member of the Communist Party, correct.
So is, wasn't that Sinhala Buddhism, the cry of Sinhala Buddhism opposed to the then principles of the Communist Party?
Well, you see, I think it is correct for you to say that it is not completely in line with accepted Marxist theory. Mm-hmm. But it was nevertheless accepted as the principle of the Ceylon Communist Party. That we should accept the symbols of Bandaranaike because the primary task was to defeat the UN. Mm-hmm. So in that context, I don't think that we did wrong.
Mm-hmm. What about the strata from which the MEP candidates were drawn?
By MEP you mean SLSP?
Mainly
SLSP. Well, you see, I believe that I came here, I should imagine, 2 months before the election. Mm-hmm. And the impression at that time was that certainly the organizational, higher organizational level of the UNP would guarantee a UNP victory. So for that reason, not many people were willing to contest on the SLSP ticket, for one thing. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the question of money arose, and a large number of people, candidates who were eventually elected, mm-hmm. had, I think, to turn to Mr. Bandaranaike personally, even for their deposit of 1,000 rupees. So it was possible for Mr. Bandaranaike to handpick in a number of areas candidates he wanted. Unfortunately for him, the candidates he chose didn't belong to the classes educated, not in Sinhala alone, but not educated in kind of not educated in English, in that they were not aware of international currents, political currents, cultural currents. They were national in every sense of the term. Their minds were also national in perspective and not international in any way.
Mm-hmm. So in this sense, he was the victim too of the circumstances which brought him to power, in that he had very mediocre talent to draw.
Let us put it like this, that the ideas which he enunciated all along were the primary factors that brought him into power.
Yes.
I think you will agree with that. Yes. What we are talking therefore is that the material with which he had to translate those ideas into reality. Mm-hmm. From that point of view, even the choice of his cabinet, he was very much a primus in the definition of primus inter pares. Mm-hmm. Because the others were so mediocre that to be trivial, he was an oasis in a desert of mediocrity, with the possible exception of C.P. De Silva, because C.P. had entered the civil service, mm-hmm. and had some training in administration. Mm-hmm. The others were extremely poor material intellectually.
Going back to the elections itself, from where did the SLSP draw its funds?
Curiously, the SLSP did not spend as much as one imagines they did. For this reason, I think, the UNP so stage managed the election that they held it over a period of 3 days, at intervals of 4 days in between. They thought that the first day's results would be so overwhelmingly in their favor that the other 2 days' results would be a matter of form.
This
boomeranged on the UNP. So as a result of which, the most amount of spending is usually done during the last 3-4 days of a campaign. Except for the first 20 or 30 odd seats which the SLSP did win, I believe it was 20 on the first day, I'm not quite sure, The rest of the candidates had very little to say. I can say that from personal experience, because Kagan was the first day victory, as was Mavananda. And they didn't spend much because they hadn't enough to spend. Places like Dadigama were second and third day victories, and those very easily we knew we were winning, and did very little work and very little expenses. Actually, the UNP candidates stopped working on the last over the last two dates of election.
So, was it consciously planned by the NEP? That is to say, they concentrated their attention on the first day?
No, I believe that the MEP concentrated all out, but the more politicalized sections within the MEP, therefore the communists and the LSSP who were supporting it, I believe that in their party organizational meeting took this into consideration. If we win on the first day, then surely we romp in on the other two. If we don't win on the first day, then the UNP is likely to form a government. For that reason, we threw everything we had into those seats which were first day seats for us.
Earlier on, you made the point that the SLSP then had very little organization, really.
Correct.
Then what helped them to win the election?
First, the anti-UNP cry. Basically, because by that I mean that the UNP was so unpopular, economically unpopular. It symbolized the European social culture. Politically, it was alienated from the people. It was considered anti-trade union. Mm-hmm. So all those anti-UNP points accrued to the benefit of the SLSP. That's the first point. So then when it came to voting, it fielded the largest number of candidates against the UNP. It had also the rallying point of Sinhala. As Bandaranaike promised he would make it the state language within 24 hours, or he would certainly do that. And as a result, this was enough, fielding as it did the largest number of candidates, for the people to vote. And the government really organized it in that sense, because the government organized an election. So the people were asked to vote on a particular day, through an organization created by the government to express their resentment against the UNP. When I talk of organization, in the sense that the LSSP and the CP understood it, we organized at that time when I was in the CP for different reasons. Politicalization, trade union, study classes, youth organizations, all patterned on foreign... Yes. Where were we?
The organization question.
Yes, so organization by that I meant the higher organization that comes of a left party all over the world, you see, vis-a-vis any other political organization. Well, you know, the centralization around the central committee and the political bureau. And because it necessarily at that time, both the Communist Party and the LSSP believed that ultimately only a revolutionary situation could bring socialism to Ceylon. So they patterned their organizations on the most successful communist movements in Indonesia, China, and the Soviet Union, and even the example of India, perhaps, you see.
What about the traditional theory about the influence of the school teachers, the Ayurvedic physicians, and the priests?
Traditional influence in the villages?
On the 56 elections, there is a theory that they were... the influence elections are great.
Well, purely because they were the most powerful symbol of the policies of Sinhala Buddhism. You see, the Sinhalese schoolmaster necessarily spoke in Sinhala to a Sinhala rural audience. The Ayurvedic physician transacted his business in Sinhala once again to a rural audience. And the Sinhalese Buddhist priest, articulate only in Sinhala language, he came in touch with the rural areas all the while. So naturally, they were the most powerful of the symbols of the policies which Bandaranaike enunciated in his campaign.
Yes, but taking the priests as a class, weren't there many who were still UNP, even in 56?
Correct. I would not say that there were many. You know, a curious feature which I noticed, I had come back, and I don't think I was here for 2 months then, but I did notice the impact of Buddha Jayanti celebrations, 2,500 years throughout the rural areas. And it almost seemed to be, we should have a Buddhist government oriented towards Buddhism for Buddha Jayanti. And the Bandaranaike had a poster, which I believe was extremely brilliant and had enormous propaganda value, which I saw, and perhaps you'd like to look at a copy of it, in IDS Veerawardhana's General Elections of 1956. It's printed again. We used that extensively here, which gave the impression that Buddhism was being attacked by the UNP. and that the UNP was attacking Buddhism in league with the Catholic Church. So those two attitudes went a long way in one bringing out the politicalized Buddhist priests against the UNP on the one hand, and neutralizing the older Buddhist priests on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you know there are these various sects in the Buddhist church itself, you see.
Were the priests organized in any way to propagandize Banda's idea?
Well, under the within an organization led, I think, by the priests at Kalaniya Temple and various other priests. But I believe, I'm sure I'm right, that M.W.H. De Silva, who was our law minister, that he had a lot to do with that organization. And I do know that when we asked for support, that's right, now I remember, that when we asked for support from, I think it was the Exa Bhikshu Peramuna, that was what it was called. And we were short of speakers to express that point of view. And when I raised this problem at a discussion meeting here, they sent a message to the Exa Bhikshu Peramuna, and they supplied us with as many priests as we wanted for our political meeting.
Weren't these priests really emanating from circles in Colombo quite often?
But they came from a social group. You know, the Sinhalese Buddhist priests, unlike the Catholic priests, who must necessarily know Latin, and therefore comes from a kind of, say, public school environment, the Buddhist priest is one other member of a village family.
I see. But they had gone to Colombo and got a bit politicalized.
Yes. But in that, shall we use the word fearless? Whereas the Sinhala Buddhist priests in our areas are slightly more timid and socially more conservative. But the Colombo Buddhist priest, like a Colombo worker vis-a-vis a peasant, you see, comes out more forcibly because he's in contact with more contemporary ideas, meets people, is not frightened, and doesn't live in the security of a monastery.
What about Kegala itself? I presume you knew quite a lot about the elections here. Who were
Kalugalle contested? A person called Winston Wickramasinghe. And Kalugalle had an enormous advantage in that, one, Wickramasinghe was a Roman Catholic and Kalugalle was a Buddhist. Wickramasinghe belonged to one of the richest families in the island, not merely Kegala. Yes, one of the richest families in Ceylon. Secondly, his social connections are of the highest within the UNP, about which the poorer people know nothing except that they live in such splendid isolation. Kalugalle is the son of a Veda Mahatmya. He was a proctor. He married the daughter of a notary and kept in touch with the village because he has a large number of poor relations. And he much more truthfully symbolized the aspirations of the rural middle class and the lower middle class poor than ever did the UNP at that time.
Perhaps Wickramasinghe might have been unpopular because of the activities of his father.
I don't think really. I don't think really, because then I should not be popular within the left circles and the SLFP, because father was so closely associated with the nerve center of the UNP political group. I don't think that. I have personally never experienced any suspicion, any hostility because of my social antecedents. So I don't think it's fair for me to say that Winston Wickramasinghe's father was responsible for Winston's own defeat. There is this much, however, I can say. No, except this I can say, that Winston's father was defeated by Mulla Murid as a Sinhala Buddhist versus a Christian Catholic. Whereas Mulla Murid himself was born and baptized a Christian, but he had become a Buddhist and so campaigned that he was defending Buddhism. I do remember that on several occasions, Kalugalle was equated to Mulla Murid against Winston as being the symbol of the Catholic Church, and that it would be Kalugalle kind of reflecting the Buddhist surge in Kegala that would break the Catholic Church. From that point of view, it is possible that there was some slight shift, but I wouldn't use the word unpopular.
Won't you also take 1956 as a symbol of the work of the voter reaching political maturity? Earlier, they had selected local notables. In 56, for various reasons, they selected their own representatives.
Don't you think that by doing that, you are attributing to the worker, the peasant rather than the worker, a degree of maturity Well, I wouldn't use the word in a snobbish way. Mm-hmm. By that time, I think, firstly, he was disgusted with the UNP. That is what I noticed. Mm-hmm. And he was protesting against what he could stand nobody, what he couldn't stand any longer. So he would, my idea was to hell with these fellows, anybody but the UNP. So I can well imagine that at that time, if the LSSP and the Communist Party and the Philip Gunawardene had joined together on a Marxist program, economically accepting Sinhala Buddhism as their symbol, they'd have swept into power despite this so-called anti-Marxist feeling that the Buddhist priests are able to generate now.
In fact, taking that argument further back, if Bandaranaike had left the UNP, and if he had been in the UNP in 56, yes, and you had organized this sort of platform, you would have still come.
If he had not left the UNP,
yes,
probably would have. As a matter of fact, the UNP rather cruelly says that the best thing that did happen was that Bandaranaike left the UNP and so guaranteed a little longer life to the national bourgeoisie in this country. But what they do forget is that they taught Bandaranaike socialism also by compelling him to turn increasingly to the radicalized anti-UNP forces in the country and pick up their programs against the UNP. And the Bandaranaike, from that point of view, is much more radical, much more politicalized than ever Mr. Bandaranaike. This is my personal experience of both of you. ජේනන් දුව මේකෙන් මොනවද කරන්නේ අපි?
Very interesting about Mrs. Bandaranaike, because when she came to Oxford and met the Oxford president, who was a West Indian.
Ah, yes.
He said that, I met him later. He felt that basically she was a progressive, and he's a left-oriented politician today, I should say. But in what particular spheres do you feel that she is more radical?
Do you not like to place her in between Nehru on the one side and Swekarno on the other? You see, she is much more politicalized, much more radical, much more socialist and fearless to take decisions on economic matters than Nehru was. But at the same time, she has a greater faith in parliamentary democracy, in two parties, in the necessity for an opposition. That's what Karma has. So I could not find another Asian leader with which to equate her to. But I do believe that take for example the nationalizing of insurance. Take the problem of the banks and breaking the stronghold of British economic interests here. Take petrol. On three issues, she has acted far, far ahead than the Indian Prime Minister ever did. So she believes, I still think, in an economy in which some opportunity is given for private enterprise. And it is not possible to ignore that the SLSP is supported by the rising Sinhala big business group. There is no question about that, as opposed to the comprador groups that are strongly allied with British and alien firms and Indian groups. So to that extent, receiving support from those elements, of necessity, the SLSP and its leadership must make concessions to them. But that group, as in India in 1915, is a progressive force. Like Tata and Birla were in 1915 progressive forces. It is for us now to watch to what extent Maliban will continue to be a progressive force supporting the SLSP government, as much as MD Gunasena, Davasa and the Sun group supported her until such time as a decision was taken to take over the school textbooks. Then when their economic interests were affected, their loyalty swung to the UNP. But they are still emotionally with the Sinhala Buddhist line. And if some degree of economic exploitation can be guaranteed to them, they may well be with the SLSP again.
This presents a problem to the Marxists, doesn't it? Because according to their theory, ultimately you have to strike at these economic interests too.
Now, what I am telling you now is not intended to be the last word on the subject, but why do you not accept that the parties which call themselves Marxist have jettisoned fundamental Marxist attitudes and become essentially pragmatic in the context of Ceylon politics. Mm-hmm. We might, a handful of people so imbued with theory in the Marxist movement mm-hmm. might flatter themselves that this is also an aspect of Marxism, what they are doing now. Mm-hmm. But I think it's much more honest for them to accept that in the present context, Marxism and Marxist theory is inapplicable when you accept the leadership of the SNL. Mm-hmm. And Ceylon being an island confined to 10 million people, you cannot possibly conceive of the success of a revolutionary movement just now. So at the present, our perspectives are parliamentary. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the Marxists should accept that situation and say that the revolution might succeed in India, in areas where there is large land surface with boundaries proximate to the Soviet Union and China from where support can come, because it's an international problem now. You cannot fight out the revolution in isolation unless it was a place like Argentina. Mm-hmm. One of those Latin American or African states, but for Ceylon, the concrete case. When Indonesia failed, we are unlikely to succeed. So why should a large number of lives be sacrificed for a theory?
Yes, but what is the difference between pragmatism and opportunism? Where do you draw the line?
Now, opportunism must of necessity be self. Mm-hmm. Pragmatism can be for a cause. That is how I would define the difference, mm-hmm. distinguish between the two. For instance, if the entirety of the Marxist movement exchanged principles for jobs, that is not pragmatism but pure opportunism. Mm-hmm. But you must accept that the Marxist leadership today, even though I do not agree now with certain of their basic principles, I mean I think you must accept that they are making a tremendous sacrifice to put the SLSP in, and they are losing by doing it. They are losing positions which they held. They are being sullied for doing this. But nevertheless, they think that what they are doing is correct, and to that extent they are making a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Therefore they are pragmatic. Mm-hmm. But I do concede that pragmatism is a word alien to Marxism. That I concede. Then that's an ideological matter. Mm-hmm. That becomes a matter in which academic dispute is possible, a dialogue occurs. You see, if it is possible between the Soviet Union and China, if it is possible between the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, why not between the Marxist parties and the Social Democratic parties in Ceylon, of which the SLSP is a Social Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm. Now, you were speaking about these fairly radical policies, but does that flow from a really coherent program or philosophy, or is it merely steps into which she is forced by elements within her party in order to win votes?
Well, let me put it this way, that this is what I think, that Bandaranaike swept into power almost by accident, as it were, in that the elections boomeranged against the UN. In the process, after he came into power, he formulated economic policies alternative to what the UNP had put across hitherto. Mm-hmm. Even that was too advanced and radical for the reactionaries within the UNP. Then he was assassinated by the right wing of the UNP, by the right wing of the SLSP, undoubtedly drawing inspiration from UNP political policies. I wouldn't go so far as to say individual UNP people helped in that, because that is incidental. I mean, that's a matter for lawyers and the police. That has nothing to do with our discussion now. But surely, Mrs. Bandaranaike accepted the moment she came in that the people responsible for destroying her husband had political views hostile to the political views her husband had enunciated and fought for. She believed that her husband was assassinated not because he was he, but because he espoused a cause which was hostile to capital in Ceylon. Therefore, she turned her attention to what were the points around which he wove his philosophy. And her visit abroad, especially to the Soviet Union, China, and I believe more so to Yugoslavia and Nasser, to Egypt. You see, she saw that it was possible to develop a powerful political organization with alternative political points, and that they were principles which she must believe in. I think she has flowered a lot intellectually since she took over the prime ministership. And in a way, this defeat must also be a political education of sorts, because she must now know the difficulty, how much it takes, you see.
But this use of the phrase Bandaranaike's policy, shouldn't they progress further and put this, instead of using this phrase, put it in more clearly defined form?
Yes. Well, because you are in the university, you say that. Mm-hmm. But look at China, which is communist, that often goes back to Sun Yat-sen's policies. Look at Turkey, which goes back often to Kemal Atatürk's policies. Mm-hmm. So that from that point of view, Bandaranaike is the starting point of a new era for the people. So it is evocative, the name,
mm-hmm.
in its it is, and therefore often it brings political results, and it brings the people around an idea when you also mention his name. It is obvious that she must develop policies of her own because situations arise which are fresh and have occurred after his death. But referring to Bandar Blacker gives people a starting point. And I believe that, I think you will accept this as a historian, that if 1815 was a landmark in our history, if 1915 was a landmark in our history because of the riot, 1956 is much more important than 1818, 1832, or 1848 in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you concede that as a trained historian and not a politician,
mm-hmm.
if you concede that as a university background within your ivory tower, you know, atmosphere, if you make that concession, you have conceded every one of my arguments, that Bandar Nayaka stood for a view alternative to what had occurred before.
Mm-hmm.
Once you accept that premise, that 1956 marked a radical change, economically, politically, culturally, in this country, thereafter, you will understand what it has meant to millions of people in this country, including, I say, the Tamils, who were affected by the paddy lands bill and the cooperative movement.
In what way?
Why, economically, the paddy cultivator in Jaffna was emancipated from his immediate landlord,
mm-hmm.
and the cooperative movement broke in through the middle businessman.
Has it removed the middle?
No, it hasn't, but it was making an effort to, and the Jaffna man, being much more intelligent, realized.
And they are more cooperative.
Much more cooperative minded, and they were responsive. It is our misfortune that we were not able to talk to them and come to some conclusion or some agreement on the language problem. But if that had happened, then we would have had them with us in this trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And with their reading on the Indian nationalist movement, there would have been very great efforts.
Yeah, but it would have been impossible really to win them over because of the language cry and the fact that whichever party went close to the Tamil would be at a disadvantage because the other party would use it in the...
If the Tamils had accepted that Sinhala should be the state language,
mm-hmm.
and accepted also that concession should be made provincial-wise for the development of Tamil, then this would have there would have been no problem at all. The tragedy was that the left had not made such inroads there as to make the LSSP and the CP the mouthpiece of the Tamil community. Instead, the Tamil Congress and the Federal Party developed, you see. But I must confess, I am weak on the Tamil problem. You know, I haven't read enough. Two, I am not yet able to comprehend totally, from an emotional angle, which primarily is the problem there, what their reflexes are.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know this, that Kolona, for instance, 1 week ago, the tide swung appreciably in our favor after the victory of the DMK in Madras.
You mean the ordinary voter took that into consideration?
Very much indeed.
Mm-hmm.
It was the one theme that I thought had a response during the last 4 days of the Kolona election. Because, you know, we didn't expect the victory to be so wide. We didn't think we'd win by thousands. We thought well within 1,000 votes. And now, given wherever we win, and any place in the central provinces will be one of the DMK issues.
Tell me, returning from so many years in London in 56, how did you find this election campaign? Did you feel out of place at the start?
Curiously, I did, because I didn't know enough Sinhalese to make speeches in Sinhalese. But for the 2 months before that, I had addressed a large number of Communist Party study groups throughout the central provinces, and as a result, expressed myself in English and my ideas were translated into Sinhala. But towards the tail end of that period and before the election, I had started talking Sinhala.
No.
And though I cannot read and write it well, conversationally I am as much village in my expression. It came back swiftly.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned new political terms on the platform. And towards the end of the campaign, I wasn't nervous of the microphone.
What about the influence of the Low Contest in 56 and then again later?
In 56 it was the most important single factor,
mm-hmm.
that contributed to Bandar Nayaka's victory. In 1960, it was the greatest factor against the US, the second election.
First one, he didn't operate.
Yes, he didn't operate against the UNP. In 1966, with or without that no contest pact, Mrs. Bandaranaike would have swept in 1966 if she had to win. I don't believe that the contest pact, no contest pact had any effect on her candidate. Mm-hmm. She would have won independently or lost independently. Mm-hmm. Indeed, in the future, it would be suicidal for the Communist Party or the LSSP to run candidates against the SLSP, because they have created the impression amongst the people that a united front means unity under the leadership of Mrs. Bandaranaike and giving pride of placing the anti-UNP struggle to the SLSP. They will never be able to explain to the people how accepting those two principles, fighting and campaigning on those two principles, they now try to destroy principles by fielding candidates against Mrs. Bandaranaike's party. So this anti-UNP coalition has come to stay. The next point is whether there will be one single political party under Mrs. Bandaranaike. But I think the name will remain SLSP. I cannot see a concession being made by her to change the name of a party created by Mr. Bandaranaike.
And you lose, you like changing the name of the Indian National Congress.
To do with
the you explain.
Ah, it's coming now. Hello? Hello? Yeah, it's coming.
It's all right now.
Hey.
I was thinking of asking about 1956 and the UNP newspaper. Don't you think that in a sense the newspapers helped the SLSP to win in the sense that there was a rebound? Or was it external to the main forces?
No, I believe that the extent of the SLSP victory would perhaps be larger were it not for the propaganda of the newspapers.
Mm.
You see, the newspapers came out almost 100% with the solitary exception of Davasa, if it was in publication then. I think not. I think Lankadipa, the Times paper, and if the editor was Dhanapala, that explained my point. If the editor was Dhanapala, he had a reputation for being left. Slightly radical, you see. So I believe that during the SLSP campaign during that period, there were occasions on which he spotlighted certain SLSP points. Except for that, in the main, the press was almost totally against us.
But wasn't there a rebound against that? Wasn't it so obvious?
Would that not be a sophisticated way of looking at it from a European angle? That you know that the European worker is slightly disgusted by the interference with his point of view by the press and retaliates by this backlash that you are thinking about. Silani is so politicalized and felt so deeply about the press. That it would be safer in the hands of Bandaranaike.
Mm-hmm. No, I just raised this as a theory simply because immediately after the election, there was an obvious public demand for press control, if not a takeover.
That is correct. You are quite right. I was astonished by noticing by the vehemence of that demand, but I yet believe that it was confined to the politically knowledgeable section. Mm-hmm. That is, that not for me. Tremendous response. No other newspaper in Ceylon at that time which people could read. Unlike today, there is Apsa and the prospect of Sinhala becoming a daily and Janadina re-emerging. During that period, there was nothing. So it was useless asking the people to boycott a particular brand of newspaper without offering them something alternative to read, and at the same time educating them in the Sinhala language, because we have, I think, a reading public of about 70% now, adults, which is the highest in Southeast Asia. And not supply them with alternatives. Now you can make that appeal. You can ask 10 people to buy one daily newspaper and share it amongst the rest. For 9 others to try to buy its English opposition equivalent. In the absence of an alternative newspaper, it is impossible to call for a boycott. I think she has cottoned on to it and doesn't want to open her mouth because she's frightened that it will stay there.
What do you think of Bandaranaike's performance as a from 56 to 59 as a government?
Socialism, or the promise of socialism, the start of certain socialist enterprises without discipline. I think the tragedy was that we taught the workers and the peasants their rights, but not their obligations. And that came of not having a disciplined political party. You see, in Eastern Europe immediately after the war, it was possible for the Communist Party to call for greater effort, greater sacrifices, because of a higher level of political discipline in their organization. Here, the Ceylon voting public has also been taught to ask the government to do everything for them. Therefore, they have enormous amount of rights. They have not been taught correspondingly their obligations.
Doesn't this mean that in a democratic setup, whichever government is in power is likely to lose the next election? Because they can't satisfy the demands, the insatiable demands of the public.
You see, that would sound right, but that would mean that you do not have faith in the capacity of a worker and a peasant to respond to a higher objective, to a higher ideal. I do believe myself, personally, from my limited experience of working amongst them, that if you tell them and you prove to them by facts and figures, and you are able to educate them, not to a very high level, but give them perspectives and say, if you make these sacrifices, within a reasonable period of time, this is possible. Then the workers will respond and make those sacrifices, and the government can continue in power. For that reason, I think the Bandaranaike's government could well have cut the rice ration, and there would have not been the uproar and the outcry that there is under the UNP. In the UNP, it looks as if the class in power, without making any sacrifices, is calling upon one section of the population to make sacrifices. As a result, it can be voted out of power. There is nothing the UNP has done in these 3 years of power, or 2 years of power, which the working class or the peasantry can claim as their victory through the government. On the other hand, the paddy lands bill became a people's victory, a symbol of the people's victory. For that reason, having given them that bill, you could in return ask them for sacrifices to support the government and for the future. So then it's a problem of capital formation that you're talking of, what sacrifices they make for capital formation to be used for industrialization. If it is simple enough for you and me, then I think that if you explain it in simple terms to the peasantry, they will respond.
But the point is, about the Paddy Lands Bill, has this been operated?
Paddy Lands Bill?
Isn't it a dead letter in many areas?
I wouldn't say dead letter, but it has its effectiveness has been shown in many areas. But at least here is an idea which people realize can be developed into a mighty weapon in their favor later on. So that the only government that did give them that opportunity was the SLSP. And there is nothing, tell me one thing that you know, I mean from an academic point of view, one such item that the UNP has given the people. Even poor day, it looks as if the UNP was forced to give it, because otherwise the SLSP would have given it anyway when they came back into power.
About the president there, it was Philip who was responsible for it, and he's now in the UNP.
Yes, that is true. But you know, fortunately, that is a personal tragedy, undoubtedly a personal tragedy, that a person of the background and reputation of Philip Gunawardene should necessarily have tied himself up with the UNP. But our people, I think, are now sufficiently educated not to be over-emotional in judging political problems. And for that reason, that there may be a group emotionally unhappy about what Philip has done, but politically aware that Philip must now be destroyed if the people are to progress. ඒක ගිලුනොත් මොනවද කරන්නේ? ඒක ඕනේද?
ඕනේ.
ඇයි? ඒක කටේ දාන්න දුන්නේ නේ. ඕනේ. මේ මමගෙන් ඉල්ලන්නේ ඒක පින් එක ඕනේ කියන්න බෑ.
ඕනේ.
මොකද කියලා බලන්න. ඕනේ.
සරදී. ඕනේ.
ඉබුටි දිනේ
මොනවද? නැතිවද? නැතිවද? Is Philip's position largely due to personal reasons? Personal reasons.
Personal reasons meaning what?
Personal animosity is having developed within the mass.
Within the left movement?
Yes, within left movement.
Yes, to a large extent. You know, that is correct, you see. Now it is, it would be wrong, this is purely academic, the discussion, it would be wrong to attribute Philip's crossover to a Marxist interpretation in the sense that suddenly he became a capitalist. He is perhaps as poor as he was. I don't believe that he is any richer or that he has got any economic concessions from the government. So to that extent, I think you are right in saying that he is very bitter about the manner in which he was left out of the coalition in 1965. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that if he was taken in, even with NM, the entire situation in the country may well be different today. Mm-hmm. Because there would be no section of the radical movement with the UNP today to confuse the situation in the minds of the people. Mm-hmm. Even people like Rajaratnam, mm-hmm. however communal they may be, nevertheless standing up for the rights of the Kandyan peasantry, the downtrodden sections of the peasantry of the central provinces, even that section would well have been with the SLSP were it not this 65 debacle of the LSSP.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't they take Philip into the coalition?
I shall never know, really, because you see, it doesn't sound logical why he was not taken in. So this is the academic, and I believe that the only person who can answer that question, mm-hmm. all of us will speculate, but the only person who really can answer that question eventually will be Mrs. Bandaranaike.
But I was told that she wanted him in, but the section, the right wing didn't.
I don't know whether it's right, the right wing or those whom, in a personal way, Philip had embittered mm-hmm. by his rude and offensive remarks at cabinet meetings. It's a curious thing to put it like that, but I'll give you an example which I remember Maithripala Senanayake telling me. He said that when he joined the cabinet, Philip was a stranger to him. He'd known him in the personal sense, but politically a stranger. Nevertheless, because Philip came from the left and because Maithripala felt that those groups were the real core of the anti-UNP struggle, he thought he should support anything that Philip brought up in the house. So much so that those trade unions under Maithripala Senanayake's ministry, which belonged to Philip's party, Maithripala went out of his way to please during the first 3 months. Then he told me that at cabinet meeting, he found Philip lashing out at him for no real reason, attributing all sorts of motives, some of them unpleasant, economic ones, saying that Maithripala was fattening on certain groups. And Maithripala was driven by Philip to adopt an attitude of hostility, first to Philip personally, and then to Philip's union. Finally, Maithripala, who is a liberal, with quite definite radical attitudes because of his own social background and what he has gone through personally in life when he was a young man, he adopted, he joined the group ranging from R.G. Sennanayake and Stanley Soyuza on the one side, right up to Maithripala against Philip. When Philip could very well, with a little softness of language, have put his ideas across without being so belligerent and personally so offensive, and not being apologetic after either. Bandar Naika supported him personally. So the two of them could have made a very effective team against the right wing, drawing in people like Maithripala at that side, at that time, and educating people like C.P. D'Souza. Instead of which he drove them to the wall in a class differentiation, as if he took the class struggle into the SLFP and into the cabinet. And anybody who was against Philip at once turned a reaction.
And wasn't he also responsible for a sort of personal vendetta against the LSSP unions in the court while he was minister?
That is because the LSSP went all out against him personally for joining Bandar Naik in 1956. So it acted two ways. Actually, just imagine the situation. If the